One, two, three, car! And they won't be ranking Beatles songs in Africa this Christmas time. The greatest gift they'll get this year is life. When nothing ever grows, no rain, no rivers flow, do they rank the Beatles songs at all? Da 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 da. Rank the songs. Let them rank the Beatles. Oh, that's terrible.
Okay, that's enough.
It's the holiday spirit. It's in me.
That was a good surprise.
That was a good one.
I didn't see that coming.
Nobody saw that one coming, I'm pretty sure. But welcome, friends. Sorry, I felt the urge. It's the holiday season.
It's okay.
And you know I love it. This is my favorite time of year.
It is your favorite time of year. Yeah. You love Christmas.
Yeah. Had to sneak a Christmas song in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But welcome, friends. Welcome to episode 118 of Ranking the Beatles. Hope you're all doing well. I am your host, Jonathan. Over here with me, as always, the lovely, the energetic and exuberant Julia.
You're saying that to be sarcastic.
Totally sarcastic. Yes, yeah, I feel like you're falling asleep in the chair.
I am very tired of looking at numbers today.
It's okay.
Thanks.
You're a number cruncher.
I am a number cruncher.
You crunched them today.
Well, I really did.
You did the crunching. It's okay.
I really did.
Well, now it's time to relax and have a little bit of fun. So hopefully it'll perk you up a little bit. You're yawning. You're actively yawning.
Sorry.
It was really cute, though. I liked it. But anyway, hope everyone's doing well. Hope you're all having a wonderful holiday season. This is almost it for the year, y'all. Only a couple of more episodes for us this year. It's been a pretty good year. We've ranked a lot of Beatles songs.
Yes.
And got a few more to do before we all wrap up for the year. But, man, I'm excited about this week's show. It's going to be a whole lot of fun. Our guests this week are two members of a band who got their start here in New Orleans in the early 1980s. They released their classic early punk album, Condition Red, in 1981 and were hailed by Rolling Stone at the time as America's answers to The Clash. They relocated to San Francisco, where they signed to Columbia Records, and in 1984, after embracing new wave music, scored a big MTV hit with their song China from their album Good as Gold, which, along with Condition Red, was produced by David Kahn, who keen-eared listeners will know also as the producer behind Paul McCartney's Memory Almost Full album. After breaking up in 1986, singer and guitarist John Thomas Griffith went on to an ongoing career with the band Cowboy Mouth, while bassist Darren Hill found himself in artist management, working with artists like The Replacements and Paul Westerberg, Rocky Erickson, and the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, among others. Now here we are in 2023, they have reunited and reissued Condition Red, and recently performed their first full live show since 1986.
We were there.
It was scorching. It was a killer show.
It was. It was amazing.
A great time.
I stayed up past...
way past your bedtime.
11 p.m. because I was having so much fun.
Yes. There's talk of more things next year for them. So hopefully more big stuff popping and they'll be coming to a city near you to play some really, really good rock and roll.
And if they do, you should definitely go.
And we also, if you're listening to the show this week, we will have a chance for you to win a copy of Condition Red. So stay tuned for details on that later in the show. Friends, please welcome to Ranking the Beatles, Darren Hill and John Thomas Griffith of the Red Rockers.
Start running. Guns Revolution.
Darren and John Thomas, welcome to Ranking the Beatles. How's it going, guys?
Going great, Jonathan.
Yep, thanks for having us.
I think this is the first time we've ever done a podcast solely based in the future, because Darren, you're an hour ahead of us. John Thomas, you're like
72 hours
ahead of us. You're currently in Brisbane, Australia, so yeah, this is like we're time traveling and it's wild. But
John Thomas is in tomorrow, tomorrow.
John, what's the stock market gonna do tomorrow?
I'm sorry?
What's the stock market gonna do tomorrow?
I could probably do that. I could probably
orange juice futures sell.
Orange juice futures, yeah, just fell.
Sell. Well, man, it's good to see you guys. We were talking in the intro. I gave kind of the Cliff Notes version of the history of Red Rockers, and was explaining how you guys, just did this fantastic reunion show in November here in New Orleans, and you've reissued Condition Red. And it's really cool to see you guys kind of getting this time and this moment again. And I find the story that you guys have told me about kind of the recovery and the reissue of Condition Red is so fascinating. So I would love if you would kind of give our listeners a bit of the backstory of, you know, how the record came about, where it went, and how you recovered it, and how it's, you know, come back out after all these years.
Well, I'll take the first paragraph and then I'll let Darren finish it up. Long story short is we have a Cowboy Mouths has a social media guy named Chris Cohen, and he also handles Huey Lewis and the News. And a guitar player, sax player named Johnny Cola lives about an hour north of where I live in San Francisco. And somehow Chris caught wind that he had, I guess so-called inherited, all the 415 two-inch tapes that had been in a vault of Sandy Pearlman, who had bought the company.
And that's 415 Records, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Out of San Francisco. And naturally, I got in touch with Johnny Cola and said, what do you have? And he gave me a list and showed me pictures and boxes and stuff. So I made arrangements to go up there and pick them up. And Darren and I have been talking about this for the last decade, what are we going to do? We got the rights back. Because I don't think a lot of people realize that after 30 years, you get your copyrights. You have to file, but you can get your copyright back to the original owners, which is Darren and James and I. Mm-hmm. And so I went up there, picked them up, told Darren, I've got these, I've got them digitized. We can move forward on releasing this gift. That finally got James and I got with Mike Mayhew and trying to do the best remix we could. And then sent it on to Darren, and I'll let Darren take it from there. So that's where Darren came, stepped in and did all of his magic.
Well, that's where the trouble began. So the thing about that record was it was our first record, and I thought it really defined us in our scene and our generation in a way. And our punk rock legacy was never, it was sort of lost and forgotten, partially because these master tapes had been missing. So once our record, which sold really well when it came out in 1981, once it was out of print and Howie had sold 415, I mean, that was it. It was gone. I mean, it was never put digitized and put online on iTunes or any of that stuff. So, you know, what I meant by like, here's where the trouble began is because we had all been, James, John, and I had been searching for a reason to get back together and play again together, but we needed the reason, and this was it. So once we found the tapes, it was like, all right, I guess we got to do this now. So one thing led to another. I talked to a couple of labels, got us a deal, and they reissued the record with, you know, bonus tracks and all that stuff, some sweet red vinyl. And so then we had to play a show to celebrate it in New Orleans. And it's probably, there were probably like 3 months this year that were probably the most fun I've ever had in my life, getting together with James and John again and going through these songs and playing them and laughing and just having the best time. It was like we were kids again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that in a nutshell is how it kind of came together.
Yeah.
I love when the universe speaks to you. It's like, okay, enough talking about getting together. Now I'm going to force your hand.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was it. Right. It's like, it's now or never. You know, here's our reason. And
yeah,
got to shit or get off the pot.
Yeah. It's that nice little universe kick in the ass that we all need sometimes of like, oh, all right, yes. All right. We'll do it.
Yes.
And then you're like, oh my God, this is so fun.
Yeah.
You know,
play exactly. Tipitinas.
Right. Well, and it's so funny because like there's been, you know, I don't know what year the poster is from, but there's a poster when you walk into Tipitinas right on one of the first kind of ballasts that are across the building. It's, you know, tonight only, see it in person, the Red Rockers. It looks like it's maybe from like 83, 84, you know.
It's 83.
83. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, yeah. What was it like going back in there after all those years for you guys? I mean, Griff, I know you've played it, you know, numerous times, and Darren, I'm sure you've been there, if not played it in other bands since then. But, you know, like what kind of things kind of took you by surprise reapproaching it after all these years?
Go ahead, John.
Well, I guess just to say, you know, with the exception of like the interior has changed since those days, of course. They've blown the roof out and have a balcony now. They didn't have that. And I remember seeing a lot of faces. And one of them was this girl, this lady who owned a place called the Beat Exchange. And she was working the door when we'd go and play there, Barbara Hoover. And you had to walk in, that front door was like on the side. And you walked out of through a foyer, I guess, a little brief little thing. And then the wall opened up and then you go inside the club. And the stage was a lot lower. It was about knee level back then, as I recall it. And I was just kind of reminiscing about what it used to look like a lot when I was there. Just kind of wild. I still do, even when Cowboy Knot plays there once in a blue moon. It takes me back to those early 80 days. And I just go, man, probably none of these people in here even remember what this place used to look like. I mean, it was run down.
Yeah.
So that's my memories of the old days.
To me, it was like being able to play at Tipitinas is like playing Boston Garden, because you had, you know, Professor Longhair and all these other, you know, these great posters hanging above you. And it's just like, you know, I was fortunate enough to play the old Boston Garden one time, and you look up and you've got like Larry Bird and John Havlicek and Bob Cousy and all these retired players, you know, jerseys. And to me it was sort of that feeling of like, man, I'm in the home of champions.
Yeah.
Right. I agree.
Yeah. And
except you replaced the jerseys with all these great posters.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
On the wall.
Yeah. and as you're re-listening to this record, you know, some 40 years later, you know, how does it hold up for you? I mean, I feel like, you know, listening to the first record I ever made is such a weird situation sometimes, because like you critique things, you think about things differently, you're a different person. But it's still, you know, it's exciting in so many weird ways. How has it been for you guys reapproaching it after all these years?
Well, for me and for Hunter, like Darren said, we had so much fun relearning these songs and laughing and cutting up and just kind of, wow, you know, it just amazed me. A lot of the chord changes were really a little difficult at first, you know. It's like, wow. Just go by so fast, and you just go, wow, I can't believe I was 18 or 19 years old and we were writing this stuff. You know, that's what fascinates me.
Yeah.
Going back and listening to it and going, wow, Dead Heroes, Darren wrote, and I still love that song to go in. That's one of my favorite songs on that record.
We were simpletons. John was the only real musician in the whole band, and he pretty much, you know, coached James and I. And just hearing these songs, like we were simpletons, you know, the songs that James and I would write were just like very rudimentary in a way, because we didn't know the proper music rules that you needed to follow to write a song. So we just did what we liked. And, you know, in hindsight, some of those songs, like our drummer said, that's a really sophisticated song. And I'm like, what? It's like a, you know, a three chord punk song. He goes, no. Right. No.
I agree with Darren. When you look back on it, you're learning all these songs, you're thinking, man, we wrote this? Holy shit.
Yeah.
But that, the whole process was rejuvenating, because we kind of climbed back into our, you know, 18, 19 year old skin and, you know, got to live again.
Yeah. Yep. And it wasn't until the next day when your knees hurt again and your back sore.
Right,
Oh, man. What were
It's funny that everybody was joking about when we announced the show that it was going to be sponsored by AARP, and here the Stones are, you know, doing the whole tour. So I don't feel as bad.
Right. Oh, man. I want to take a step back here and pose this to Darren, because, like, you know, we've had John Thomas on the show before, and we've talked about kind of his entree into the Beatles. So, Darren, I pose the same to you. What's kind of your origin story with the Beatles as it relates to you?
Oh, man, my Beatles, first Beatles experience could be taken a couple of different ways. And I don't look at it this way, but you could almost look at it as child abuse, because I had a babysitter who was a teenage girl, 1964. And when she'd come over to babysit me, she would bring this little plastic Beatles guitar and one of those Beatles wigs that you buy at Woolworths. And would put them on me, and she would put on her records, her 45s, and make me, you know, mime to these things and dance around. And I was 4 years old, so it scarred me for life.
Oh, dude, I wish you could find a picture.
Yeah, I do too.
I know. I think she has one.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I often wonder if the kids I used to babysit when I was a teenager will now complain about having to listen to Nirvana.
Right.
Uh-huh.
It just made me think about that. I'm like, oh, I vividly remember like putting Nirvana on and these kids being like, what's this? I'm like, it's Nirvana. You don't know anything. You're just a kid. Just being a surly teen.
Yeah.
And when did it kind of make like a real impact though on you? Like, as far as like the idea of like wanting to be a musician or be in a band and kind of like absorbing like the power of songs and things like that.
Certainly, you know, they did. And I think my first real entree into just how magnificent the Beatles were was in English class. And we had this hip, probably my freshman year of high school, had this super hip English teacher, English lit. And, you know, his curriculum were Lennon McCartney songs for the most part. And it was just, I just said, wow, that's it, you know? And then, you know, around that time, I think they put out the red and the blue records,
yep.
The double greatest hits thing or whatever, because albums were kind of expensive. And I didn't have all the Beatles records. I had a couple. I had Sgt. Pepper, of course. But so, you know, getting those two records and being exposed to some of the earlier stuff and then some of the more obscure later stuff. And it just led one thing to another. And pretty soon I was buying like bootlegs. There was a record store out by the lake that they had a packed room, and they would have all these great bootleg records. And you know, that's where all the stuff that you hear now was available then on these records.
Mm-hmm. Was that the old Peaches there?
No, it wasn't Peaches. It was some dude's name. It was the weirdest place in the world, but he had gold mine of records.
That's pretty much every record store ever, the weirdest place in the world.
Yeah, pretty much. But that's where you went to get educated, you know, on music.
And how did you feel they kind of impacted the punk scene at the time? Because I'm always really curious about how that music impacts that world, because a lot of that stuff, especially like the earlier, like late 70s, early 80s punk, is still super, there's still a lot of melody, and it's like the songs are economical and kind of like the hallmarks of the Lennon-McCartney style is like economy, melody, hook, and like y'all stuff certainly, you know, bears those same hallmarks. So I'm always kind of curious, like, if you sense that same influence in that world as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That was the mold for a rock band. Yeah, you know, in a way.
Yeah,
and you know, certainly could vary outside of it, but that was pretty much it. They did it all. They were the first punk band, in my opinion.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's interesting. One of the things I was gonna ask later on in the show was, you know, what do you think is like the Beatles' most punk moment, or like something like that, you know?
There were so many of them. I mean, you think about it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we're bigger than Jesus Christ, and Johnny Rotten never said anything that shocking.
That crazy. Yeah.
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 Yeah. I like the fact that when they started getting really nasty with, like, you know, Revolution, the White Album, that started, you know, but early on, I mean, they were, when they started growing their hair out and being kind of really rebellious, I guess, so to speak, and got out of the suits and the ties and started really joining, I guess, the hip being
individuals. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why Rubber Soul is probably my favorite record, because to me, you look at their faces on that record and, you know, they look, they've been around the block and,
right.
You know, hair's starting to get long and they've got these weird songs. And, you know, to me, it was like the first record, like album too, in a way. It wasn't just a collection of hit singles that they had done previously. This was like a concept in a way. And
yeah. Yeah. And I was, when you brought up, you know, Revolution just now, that kind of makes me, that made me kind of just think of like, there's a definite through line, I think, between kind of the ideas of the lyrics in Revolution onto a lot of what you guys are singing about on Condition Red, which is very much a political, you know, forward thinking, you know, record at the time. And even still now, you know, like that's definitely a through line I'm catching there.
Even the Beatles were very political and very revolutionary, and even, you know, some of their more subtle versions of that, you know, that pop up on, you know, like A Day in a Life and whatnot. You know, they just paved the way for us to be able to do that, and the Clash to be able to do that, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And would you say McCartney as a bass player had any kind of impact on you, Darren, as a bassist?
Oh, it scared the shit out of me. I knew I could never, ever in a million years play that well. I mean, he was like, he must have been born with a Hofner in his hands, because it's just incredible. It just flows from his fingers, and his sense of melody is like nothing else. I think I was probably more influenced by his guitar playing, honestly.
Interesting. Okay. Interesting.
Well,
we will discuss the song.
Yes.
Yeah.
What were you saying,
Darren? I was saying that when we were in rehearsals for the show, I had gone back and I was also listening to Good as Gold, and I was fascinated. I'd never really listened to the. It's been years since I've actually picked them apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back and I said, Darren, man, I gotta tell you, dude, you played some badass bass lines all over that record.
Mm-hmm.
killer. I was really pulled the songs apart, and I was really listening to the bass lines, and I was like, man, Darren played his ass off on this record. That's some really interesting stuff.
And I have David Kahn to thank for that, too, because he kind of helped coach me a little bit, and he was a giant Beatles fan, huge McCartney fan, so I think, some of that was transferred a little bit.
I think he obviously was like, well, I've worked with Darren Hill, and now I've got to work with the next best bass player I can get, and that's Paul McCartney.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
He made that McCartney record.
About that. That's kind of mind-blowing, right? Like,
I mean, think about y'all, your 6 degrees of separation, right? You worked with David Kahn on 2 records, and then you worked with Annie Leibovitz, who obviously took numerous photos of John Lennon, if not all of them. I think she probably shot all of them.
Probably.
But yeah, you've got a pretty nice 6 degrees of separation with the Beatles there.
Yeah, I'll say. And we recorded at the record plant. And it was, John, what was it like, not even 2 years after John was killed?
John Lennon, yeah.
Because he was in there recording, like, the night he got murdered, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. The record plant, yep. And they had this at the end of the hall.
The guitar,
Oh, they had, he had donated this gigantic acoustic guitar. I mean, the thing was as tall as the wall.
It looked like a stand-up bass, only bigger.
Yeah. And it was in this glass case. I mean, you couldn't touch it, but it was pretty impressive. We were like, what is that? I think what a ripped shirt off and Bill Whitman said, oh, that was donated by John Lennon. And I think there was a plaque or something that said something about him.
And a lot of the people that worked there, John, you know, had worked on that session.
On that record.
Lennon, yeah.
But wow.
Was that the Double Fantasy record?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, it was going to be the next one? The
next one after that.
Milk and Honey.
Okay.
Yeah.
Milk and Honey.
Yeah. Because, I think that Yoko could put that out in 83. So maybe they were working on that at the same time y'all were there, when they were like overdubbing and finishing some of the stuff on that after John had died. That might have been in that 83 time. Well, man, I'm so excited for you guys with putting this record back out. It sounds absolutely fantastic. It's such a good album, and the show was great, and I'm really hoping that, you know, there's more stuff in the future for you guys, so more people can get this experience.
Well, it's a good time to do it, man. Like Dave Grohl says, it's times like these. It's times like these when we need punk rockers.
Yep.
Yes, indeed.
And is it weird to put out a record 40 years later that's still just as timely as it was 40 years ago?
Yeah, but that's kind of
is weird.
That's kind of the stuff that we kind of laughed about or realized when we were rehearsing. It's like, wow, you're singing the lyrics and you're going, man, I think this is more important than it is back then.
Yeah.
It is today.
You know what it proves? It proves that Devo's theory of de-evolution is real.
Shit.
Yeah.
And we're in it.
Yep. Oh, man. Well, guys, let's go ahead and turn the page and talk about our song of the week. Friends, coming in at number 97 is Good Morning, Good Morning.
Nothing to do to save his life, call his wife in. Nothing to say, but what a day, how's your boy been? Nothing to do, it's up to you. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
Good morning, good morning, good morning,
going to work, don't wanna go, feeling low down. Heading for home, you start to roam, then you're in town. Everybody knows there's nothing doing. Everything is closed, it's like a ruin. Everyone you see is half asleep, and you're on your own, you're in the street. After a while you start to smile, now you feel cool. Then you decide to take a walk by the old school.
nothing has changed, it's still the same. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
Good morning.
When the Beatles decided to give up touring at the end of 1966, each retreated to their own respective worlds to enjoy some much-needed rest and recovery. While George dove into Indian music, Paul explored the avant-garde art world and the London social scene. Ringo enjoyed being a new dad to a growing family, as his son Zach had been born just a year prior, and he and his wife would have their second, Jason, in August of 67. Meanwhile, John found himself at home, detached from his bandmates and friends, in a sprawling estate in the Stockbroker Belt area of Weybridge. Despite taking a few weeks out to film his role in the film How I Won the War, he spent the bulk of his time sitting at home, getting high, and taking a lot of acid. He wasn't out having real-life experiences, so the songs that he did manage to write during this time tend to either look backward at his own life history, like Strawberry Fields Forever, or their observations and inspirations from things around in his everyday life, like the drawing his son Julian made of a classmate that turns into Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, or the old circus poster on the wall that contained most of what would be the lyrics for Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, the newspaper stories he was reading that gave birth to A Day in the Life, or the Kellogg's Cornflakes commercial that he turns into Good Morning, Good Morning. That's right, listeners. Cornflakes, as John sat at the piano one day with the TV on in the background, a Kellogg's ad caught his ear in the background featuring the jingle,
good morning, good morning, the best to you each morning, sunshine breakfast.
Kellogg's Cornflakes, none crisper, none fresher.
Sidebar, trivia question that I got right on our last episode.
Yeah, you did.
With Debbie Davis.
Yeah, you did.
Nice.
Nice, Jules.
And that's before I had even done these notes. As John tended to write lyrics first, he developed a song around his lyrics that featured a really convoluted assortment of time signatures, which are captured in the song as early on in the process as the sparse home piano demo he makes for the song. The Beatles began working on this track February 8, 1967, with the basic track featuring John on rhythm guitar, Ringo on drums, Paul assisting on the floor tom, and presumably George on the tambourine yet again. They just keep putting him on tambourine. I don't get that. It took eight attempts, right? It took eight attempts to get a backing track, which the band then sat on until February 16th, when John adds his lead vocal and Paul then adds his bass track. Over the next few weeks, John took some time to think about what else the song needed. He decided he wanted to have a horn track for it, but insisted he didn't want to use the usual straight-laced brass players that they would normally get. So on March 13th, they brought in Sounds Incorporated, a fellow Liverpool group that they'd known for years, that had been the support act for the band in 1965, and who were also managed by Brian Epstein, and worked with George Martin to develop a brass score. The horns were then run through EMI's ADT and flange effects, limited and compressed to do whatever they could do to meet John's request that the horns not sound ordinary. On March 28th, John re-records his lead vocal, and then lead guitar was added that day by Paul McCartney. Now, to wrap up the song, John had a final idea, and is very thought out. This may also owe some inspiration to the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album, which ends with the songs of dogs barking as the last track fades out. John wanted a virtual parade of animals, each successive one being one that could eat or scare the animal before it. These effects were pulled from the EMI sound effects collection and added to the track. Now, the song was, of course, released in May of 1967 on the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album. It was never performed by the band or any of its members solo. And a final bit of trivia, a visitor at the initial recording session for Good Morning, Good Morning was Monkees drummer Mickey Dolenz, as the groups were actually quite friendly with each other at this time. Dolenz went on to direct the final episode of the Monkees TV series, and for that episode, secured permission to use the song at the beginning of the show, in what was the first time the Beatles licensed one of their master recordings out in such a manner. Mickey would also go on to release a really nice cover of this on his 2012 album, Remember. So, why do I have Good Morning, Good Morning at 97? So I think this song gets a pretty unfair bad rap. It's surrounded by so many big hitters on the Sgt. Pepper album, which is, in terms of albums, this is a really big hitter itself also. It's not a big lyrical, dreamy tour de force like some of Lennon's other big tracks on here. And while arguably it's, you could say it's as amazing a production as maybe Mr. Kite might be, it doesn't have the same level of psychedelia. It's a bit more straight ahead, so it tends to go under the radar. It also doesn't help that Lennon called it a throwaway, because of course he did. He does that all the time. To me, though, this is kind of a link between Revolver and Sgt. Pepper. As a track itself, the band just rocks, and it's great to see those rare moments on this album where they get to kind of be a rock band. I've mentioned before, I'm a big fan of the drum sounds the Beatles are getting in 1967. This song's no exception. I really love the quarter note pattern that Ringo does here, and it's one that he tends to use whenever John writes a song with a complicated time signature. It helps simplify the beat for the listener, which keeps songs like this from losing their groove and kind of sounding like Rush or something like that. Paul predictably plays a really great bass track on here, on his Rickenbacker, which lets him really dig in rhythmically, and it syncs up in places where he's also doing these floor tom fills. So you get these cool, really deep syncopations that are really neat. And of course, his guitar solo is just killer on here. Not sure why George didn't do the solo. By all accounts, he wasn't at some of these sessions. He was more preoccupied learning Indian music, so it may have just been done out of necessity. But Paul rips a great solo that seems kind of like a sibling of his Taxman solo on this song. I also think it's just a really fun song. It's a great production. It's got some real oomph to it. It sounds fantastic. It may not be a tour de force as a song, but as a track, it's just killer. And I'm a big, big fan. So that's my thoughts. Darren, I'll throw it to you first, man. What do you think?
All right. It's not one of my favorite Beatles tracks, but you have to put it into the context of it being the Beatles. And that the Beatles began making albums, and I'm a big fan of the art of the album. And Sgt. Pepper certainly was one of the first. And in that respect, I think the song is great because it feels a really beautiful connection on the record, much like, you know, a Broadway musical would have. It's a great song in that respect, and in respect that Sgt. Pepper is the greatest album ever, then, you know, by default, this has to be one of the greatest songs ever. And I think to me, what puts it in the top 10 of all Beatles songs is Paul's solo that we had talked about earlier. It's just ripping. It rips your head off. It's so punk, I think. Mm-hmm. And then Ringo, my God, you know, people that say, you know, Ringo wasn't the greatest drummer, they're full of shit, because I mean, listen to just the time changes. I mean, was that recorded as a continuous track, mm-hmm. or was it spliced together?
No, this was all one track. They spent time rehearsing this.
I mean,
this.
He just changed. Every bar has a different time signature. Yeah. It's just incredible, like, that he could do that.
And he's just following the lead of, because, like, John's writing to the meter of his lyric. Like, he's not, the lyric itself doesn't flow as a 4-4 thing. So it goes, like, 3-4 to 5-4 to 4-4, and Ringo just is smart enough to go, if I just play quarter notes, we're going to hit the one together at the end of the phrase. And it's perfect.
Right? How genius is that?
Yeah. And he does the same thing in, like, All You Need Is Love. And it's perfect. It's all it needs is that simple little pattern, and it works.
Yep.
So you would put this in a top 10 for you. Is that what I'm getting? Even though it's not one of your favorites.
Only because it's in the... It's tough because not as a standalone song, but as a song that's a cohesive piece of Sgt. Pepper. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I can't argue with that.
What's the sequence that goes before? What's the song before? That's it. It's actually the opening track on side two of the album. Right?
No, you've got Lovely Rita is before this. And then you have Good Morning, Good Morning. Then Sgt. Pepper reprise. And then A Day in the Life.
Okay.
But like Darren, the way that you were kind of considering it, like the idea of like a musical, you know,
yes.
If a musical ends with like a reprise of a theme and then like a big finale, which is like your Sgt. Pepper, All You Need Is Love, or A Day in the Life, this is kind of like the big grand finale song before, not a finale, but like the big high water mark that kind of like
building up.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's this. And
I agree.
And it's also rare, I think, to have a really kind of big up-tempo rock song on the back half of a record.
Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hadn't been done to that time.
Yeah. John Thomas, what are you thinking, my friend?
I have to agree with Darren wholeheartedly, both of you guys. I just, one of my notes I put down was the general attitude of most Beatles songs is a really positive. It's always positive. There's nothing really negative about it. And this is one where it's like, I felt like Lennon was doing, you know, no matter what you do in your life or how bad it gets, it's okay. It's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I kind of read into it. I just love the fact that he could write about, it feels like you knew the people, like he knew the people he's talking about, like personally.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I agree with you guys about that, the change in the rhythm, the switch of rhythm from going from pop, 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 pop to the bum, 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 and then going boom back into the other bit. I just thought, yeah, I got to agree with you. Ringo was the shit, the schnizzle. I mean, keep that together, man. That was pretty hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think this is also the Sgt. Pepper record in general, too. It's the beginning of I guess that multi-layer, like the different rhythms, like, you know, like, what's the song? I Want You. And they go through, mm-hmm. they go through kind of a rock to a mamba. To like I don't know. They go through three or four different patterns.
Yeah.
Of the I Want You to the jazzy, mm-hmm. they go from to a jazz thing to a swing. They're kind of like sounds like a mambo kind of beat, I guess.
Yeah.
I think this was the beginning of that whole like Darren says, it sounds like, you know, okay, this was recorded and this was recorded another time and they're pieced together.
Mm-hmm.
They were so good at that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, making it sound like really two different songs were just glued together.
Mm-hmm.
But they made it work and it made sense.
Yeah.
But it feels like it feels like it belongs together still, sort of like the Abbey Road medley. Like, you can't listen mm-hmm. to one part of the Abbey Road medley without hearing the entire section.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't, they don't right. exist separate from each other. It is the Abbey Road medley.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Right.
Good point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. They are super good at a little bit of chaos. Like, it's.
Yeah. That's yeah. interesting because this is kind of a chaotic. I don't know if it's the mix is chaotic or like the parts can be kind of chaotic because like there are times when there's a lot happening, but it's kind of like a controlled chaos, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Agreed.
What are you thinking, Julia?
This does not feel like controlled chaos to
no?
me.
Does it feel like no, uncontrolled? Does it feel like chaos at all to you?
It feels very much like chaos to
yeah.
me. Like, that's immediately what I thought of. Even the sort of, even though the lyrics are sort of alluding to, like, to me, it reads like boring daily life for non-Beatles people, like
yeah, yeah.
like a me but it feels like that sort of boring person day in day out chaos of just like these are the things that happen throughout your day kind of stuff, like
mm-hmm.
sort of going to work and there's traffic and there's people and there's da 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 da, you know what's that?
Yeah. Oh, I was gonna say I want to kind of praise Darren, because you know we did this I don't know, forgot who came up with the part, but it's kind of like in Dead Heroes you have this opening which is like slow, like the Battle Hymn of the Republic or whatever, you know, and then it goes into the switches gears
mm-hmm.
and next thing now you're in fifth gear and just takes off.
Yeah,
that was pretty cool. I thought Darren came up with that, and I thought that was really, that's kind of our early Beatles moment, probably.
Yeah.
You know, trying to mismatch two songs that don't even have anything to do with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know,
but I think that also makes it so much better. Like, when you have something that's very slow and then it kicks in, it's very just like fuck yeah. Like, it's a good, like, amps fuck it yeah up moment. Yeah. Like, there's, okay, sorry. This is, like, total sidebar and not even the same genre, I guess. But there's this, like, Olivia Rodrigo song that I listened to recently. That's, it's, like, a very slow, like, ballady. But then it just, like, there's this one part in the song where I don't even know what the instruments are. I'm sorry, I'm not a musician. I always do this. But I feel like there's, like, maybe piano and guitar, and they just kind of, like, clang, clang. And it's just like, yeah. Like, I love that. I love that in songs. Yeah. Like, when you have that powerful moment, like, that gets you.
Stuck,
like,
him in and punch him in the face.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what you do. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're very good at sort of changing it up. And it keeps you interested as well.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps your ear interested. That I feel like that's a trick that Paul does a lot.
Oh yeah, for sure.
To, you know, like, tickle your little ear holes.
Mm-hmm.
I will say I disagree with all of you, and I do not like the guitar, like the guitar tone on the song.
It's mind blowing.
I know. I'm sorry.
It's a travesty.
I told him, and he was like, "What?
Does anyone know a good divorce attorney? Because that tone is fucking.
That's
killer.
What did it. This is what it is. This
that
is
guitar
what...
tone is rad. You're out of your. You're out of your gourd.
Well, you think that tone has been copied to death though since then?
I do.
It's pretty shrill.
I think where
it. Thank you. It is shrill.
I don't think it's as shrill as what I will. The hill I will die on is the shrillest guitar tone ever is Sympathy for the Devil. That is the worst guitar tone I've ever heard in my life. It's like being in Guitar Center with like 100 PV shitty amps.
Oh, God.
It's just.
Right. That's my idea of hell, by the way.
It's like.
Also me.
It's like being played with like a razor blade instead of a guitar pick. I think the tone is very trebly and very high end, but like, God, it's just like, it's electric. It's energy. It's just, just killer.
I'm not getting that.
No?
No. Ugh. Sorry.
How do you feel about Taxman? Well, we're not even there yet, but.
Yeah, I feel like I might have the same feelings about Taxman. Like, listening, like playing Taxman in my head movie, I'll have to like play it later, but I feel like I might have the same.
Mm.
Ugh.
Well,
when we get to Taxman, I'll have to refer back to my notes for today, and you'll have to ask me that question again.
Yeah.
But yeah, it feels very chaotic, and that guitar tone is like not pleasant to my ears.
Okay.
Sorry.
You're entitled to the opinion. It's okay.
Oh, thank you for your permission.
You are welcome. Quite welcome. So at 97 out of 223. Do we think I'm off base? Am I close? Now, Darren, you said with context considered, this is a high one for you. But without context, where would you put it?
No, I think you're right on.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
If you remove the context.
John Thomas?
I agree with Darren. I agree with both of you. Yeah. It's a good ranking.
What about you, baby?
Makes sense.
I don't know that I argue too much. I might move it back a little.
Yeah,
but like, I don't know, because I know there's, as I always say, there's stuff that we've gone through that I like better.
Sure.
That I would always move up, so, but I wouldn't make like a huge fuss about it.
Fair enough. If
you really felt strongly about leaving it here, I'd probably let it slide.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Awesome. Well, before
we that's the great thing about the Beatles, all you need is love,
right?
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing, like, you know, the kind of the impetus behind the whole idea of this podcast was like, this is a conversation that I've had with numerous people over the years, are just like, what makes a Beatles song great? What's your favorite Beatles song? Like, blah, blah, blah. And it was like the conversations that like I always found myself having with other musicians, like backstage, just like killing time. And I'm sure you guys have had similar conversations with people, like, and that's what makes this like a great topic to just rehash over and over again.
Yeah. So.
Before we wrap for the evening, can I throw some rapid-fire questions at you guys? And mainly at Darren, because we've done these already with
Okay.
Darren.
Cool.
All right. Darren, your favorite Beatles song. And it can be of all time. It can be today if you don't have an all-time favorite.
That's impossible. Impossible. I'd be here listing 200 and how many do you have?
I got 220. Well, 223, but it's got to be 224 because there's a new song. So
seriously, because it all depends on my mood. Mm-hmm. I can't, you know.
Yeah.
What would it be today?
It might be one thing one day and the next day another one, but, you know.
If I pointed my finger at you and said, put on a Beatles song right now, what song are you putting on? What are you going to?
Whatever's around.
Fair enough. Do you have a least favorite?
I have a hard time like dialing up on Spotify or whatever. Like,
yeah,
I can't listen to like the shuffle thing. I have to like.
You need an album front to back.
Yeah.
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 If a little child said, "Tell me about the Beatles," what would you put on?
Oh.
Ooh.
Or an alien.
With a little child. Or an alien came to Earth.
That's a good idea. Good idea. That's a good idea. Do you have a least favorite Beatles song? One that you just hate?
The new one?
Yeah? Not a fan?
It's okay.
Yeah.
Was it necessary? You know, and it's nice.
Did it make you smile for 3 minutes? Then it did its job.
To put it this way, I never listened to it the second time.
Sure, okay.
It made me smile, yeah.
Then it did its job. That's all it's there for.
Was it Debbie that said, like, oh, it was nice to hear from old friends again?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite Beatles album?
Yeah, I already said Rubber Soul.
Rubber Soul, yeah, that's right. And your favorite Beatle-associated memory? This can be this has been everything from meeting a Beatle to serving a Beatle cake at a party. John Thomas's was singing "She Loves You" while jumping on the bed as a kid. It could be anything.
Well, I already told you about being scarred by my babysitter who made me dress up in the wig and the guitar and jump around the room singing Beatles songs. So. That I actually have a vague recollection of watching the Ed Sullivan Show because we watched that every Sunday in my house and seeing them on TV and trying to figure out like why all the girls were screaming like what are they doing to the girls like
how do I do that
I don't know but that's when I decided this is what I wanted to do for a living play music. That's why we started the band, right, John?
Yep.
Girls?
Yep. For the Ed Sullivan. No, I'm just kidding.
For Ed Sullivan. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I agree with Darren. You know, it's we wanted to meet girls. And we weren't baseball players and we weren't football players. So what better way to get out of the West Bank than to form a band?
Yeah.
And meet chicks, meet ladies. Have a good time.
Yeah.
I feel like that's...
And hopefully you never have to dig a ditch on the hot Louisiana highway somewhere.
Oh, right.
In the hot sun.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I'll try to avoid all kind of work possible.
Exactly.
I mean, I've seen you do manual labor, John Thomas. It's not the best.
Aww.
I'm kidding.
What's that?
I said I've seen you do manual labor. It's not your forte, but I'm kidding.
It's not my forte. No.
I kid, though.
You're too pretty for manual labor.
Thank you.
Darren, in all your travels as a musician and as more behind the scenes as well, have you ever crossed paths with a Beatle?
Oddly, I've never met one of the Beatles. I've been in the same room as Paul and Ringo. Mm-hmm. But I've never actually spoken to him, and because I was too afraid.
Yeah,
I was. Yeah.
Where was the?
I couldn't do it. I was terrified.
What was the same room? Where were you?
I went to see McCartney when he played up here at Fenway, and was lucky enough to be backstage for the meet and greet afterwards. Ringo, we stayed at the same hotel in Austin, the Four Seasons. One time, and I remember he was on the floor above me. We rode up in the elevator together, and had a nice little conversation. Yeah,
yeah,
oh, nice.
He was very pleasant.
Yeah. Nice, that's cool.
That's great.
I feel like Ringo would be pleasant. Yeah, like, what's he got to be mad about?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Unless you send him fan mail.
Oh, but yeah.
He's not signing autographs.
No more autographs. Don't ask him for his autograph. But no autograph. If you don't ask him for his autograph, I feel like he would be quite pleasant.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Well, guys, this has been super fun, man. Thank y'all for carving some time out. And I do understand that we are going to we're going to let a lucky listener win a copy of Condition Red. Is that right, John Thomas, Darren?
Yes. If you don't mind, I'd love to do a little contest to the first person would like to run it, because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that are going to get it right. So then you put them on your wheel.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And then you to spin it and select the winner.
So here's
I'll send them a. I'll send them a CD.
Okay.
A disc of the new album.
So
Red Rockers.
So here's the contest, right? You have to like the Red Rockers Facebook or Instagram page, and then comment on Ranking the Beatles on our Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, wherever, and answer the following question. What is the question?
The question is, name all 9 animals that are represented in the song.
Oh.
Good morning. Yes. Good morning.
Yes.
So that means you're going to have to listen really close. And I've got them all written. I sent them to you already. Yep. So,
So,
and you already know one because you talked about it on the show notes, so that's easy. Yep.
But go like the Red Rockers on social media. If you comment, I'm going to check and see if you're liking their page. And if you don't, you don't get entered into the contest.
Nope.
And then we will pick a winner next week, the week of the 20th-ish, Christmas week. I don't know. Whatever next week is. Time is a construct now. I don't know where we are. So where can everybody stay in touch with all things Red Rockers? Where can they pick up a copy of the record, some of the killer merch you guys have, all that good stuff?
I think Darren has a
go
link.
Go to our Facebook page or Instagram, yes. And you got links to everything there.
Sweet.
Yep.
We're too cool to have a website.
Yeah,
so.
Man.
The merch is very cool. Mm-hmm. This guy next to me had a field day at the merch table. He was like, I need a t-shirt, I need a hat, I need a poster. I was like, okay, that's a lot.
I like merch.
But I know, you do. And you wear your t-shirt all the time.
I do.
Is it comfortable?
It's very comfortable.
Good man.
Very comfortable.
It's a good looking shirt.
Cool.
And if any tour dates for next year pop up, they'll be on Facebook?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well, guys, congratulations, man. Big stuff for y'all. Really, really happy for you guys. Thank y'all for sharing it with everybody this week. And we will talk to you guys soon.
Thank you, Jonathan. Guys.
Thank you, Jules.
Thanks, y'all.
Bye.
We'll see y'all later.
John Thomas Griffith and Darren Hill, the Red Rockers, y'all. Good, good times. That was fun.
That was good times.
We're intercontinental now.
Yes.
Like, Darren's up in Providence. John Thomas is currently in Brisbane. Is it Brisbane? Brisbane?
Brisbane.
I
think so. Friends in Australia, let us know if we're pronouncing it correctly.
Sorry about that if I blew it. My bad.
We are worldwide. Wide.
Yes. But yeah, man, a lot of fun. Do yourselves a favor. Get yourself a copy of Condition Red, the newly reissued album by the Red Rockers. It fucking rocks. And if you would like to win a copy, it's over on our social media. Go and enter our little competition. Make sure you like the Red Rockers page and then comment on our page with the answer to the question. What are the animals in Good Morning, Good Morning? What do you all think, though, about Good Morning, Good Morning at number 97? Are we way too high? Are we way too low? Or just like old Baby Bear's porridge, are we?
That's right.
That's right. Give me like a little holiday spirit.
Just right.
Oh, yeah. I like it. Nicely done. Let us know wherever you are following along. If you're looking for us on the webs, you can find us on Facebook at
Ranking the Beatles.
You can find us on Instagram at
Ranking Beatles. No, Ranking the Beatles.
That's right. And you can find us on Twitter at
Ranking Beatles.
That's right. And be sure to tell a friend that you're enjoying what we're doing over here. Have them tune in and join the fun. And leave us a 5-star review if you enjoy it. We got a bad review today. We got a bad review.
Pathetic episode.
Sorry. But,
so please go counteract now the one star.
Our percentage has gone down.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, we were at like 4.8. Now we're at 4.6. It's brutal.
Our pathetic episode has really ruined our rating.
I'm sorry.
Please come give us more 5 stars.
We do the best we can over here. Limited resources we have.
Pathetic is a little drastic.
Look.
I don't know that sometimes it's not our best. I don't know if we're pathetic.
It was not pathetic. It was a fine episode.
Jeez. Brutal. But,
so that's all we got for this week, gang. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode. Until then, happy holidays. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Julia.
This has been Ranking the Beatles. Adios.
Bye, y'all.